So I want you to think about the last time you were digging for an old article or maybe a specific tutorial you bookmarked, I don't know, 5 years ago. You click the link, you're expecting that nugget of wisdom, and what happens?
404. Not found. The
Exactly.
dreaded link rot. It's like driving to your favorite restaurant only to find an empty lot.
It's the worst. And it happens because of how we built the web. We built it on addresses. When I type a URL, I'm basically telling my browser, go to this specific server, look in this folder, and grab this file.
Right.
But if the owner moves that file or renames it, or I mean, what if the server just died?
The link breaks. The
Yeah.
address is still there, but the house is gone.
Right. And that's because we're always asking, where is it?
Instead of asking, what is it?
I know.
That's the fundamental fragility of a location-based web.
But what if we flip that? I mean, what if the address wasn't a location at all? What if the address was like a fingerprint of the file itself? So specific that if you changed just a single comma in a huge document, the entire address would have to change too.
Now you're talking about content addressable storage. It's a concept that's, been around for a while in computer science, but it's usually buried in these really complex systems like Git or IPFS.
Well, today we are doing a deep dive into a project that tries to strip all of that complexity away. It's a public specification called 256t.org, and it was created by a developer named Kurt Cox. And honestly, when I first looked at this, I thought, okay, another tech standard. But the more I read the documentation, the more I realized this is it's a really beautiful philosophical shift in how we handle information.
It really is. It's so minimalist. The goal of 256 is just to create a universal way to name files based purely on their content. And it does it using nothing more than a standard URL path.
So our mission for this deep dive is to unpack exactly how this works. We're going to get into the math. Don't worry, we'll make it painless.
I promise.
And we're going to explain how a string of just 94 characters can represent anything from a simple text message to, I don't know, a 200 terabyte database.
And we're going to talk about this little loophole in the system that I think is one of the coolest aha moments I've seen in a spec in a long time.
Okay, so let's start with the anatomy of this thing. The core of 256 is the URL. But the source material lays out this really strict rule for what the path, the part after the .com has to look like.
Right. So in this system, the file name isn't something you get to choose. You can't call it myvacation.jpg. The file name is a generated string of characters, and the spec says this string can be up to 94 characters long.
94 characters. That's very specific. Why 94?
It comes down to the two parts that make up the ID. The string is split into a prefix and a hash.
Okay.
The prefix is 8 characters long, and the hash is 86 characters. Add them up, you get 94.
Let's break those down then. Let's start with the prefix. What do those first 8 characters do?
The prefix tells you the size of the file.
That seems simple enough, but I mean, usually when I download a file, my computer just figures out the size as it's downloading. Why put it in the name? It's about efficiency, really, knowing what you're getting into before you start. But the 256 system does something really clever here. It uses those 8 characters to define the maximum capacity of the entire system.
And this is where the name 256 comes from, right?
Exactly. So these 8 characters, they're encoded using something called Base64.
Right.
For anyone who needs a quick refresher, computers think in binary zeros and ones. URLs need text. Base64 is just a way to translate that binary data into safe text characters, letters, numbers, a couple of symbols. It's a translation layer.
Okay.
Now, mathematically, 8 characters of Base64 text can hold 48 bits of raw binary data.
48 bits.
And if you do the math, so 2 raised to the power of 48, you get a number that represents about 281 trillion bytes,
Wow.
which is roughly 256 terabytes.
Whoa. So you're saying that tiny 8-character code at the start of the URL is enough to describe file sizes all the way up to 256 terabytes?
Yep, that's the upper limit for any single file in this system. That is massive. I mean, the biggest hard drive you can buy in a store right now is what, 22 terabytes?
Right. So this standard is built to handle data sets that are 10 times larger than that.
Yeah.
It's future-proofed for, huge video archives, scientific data, AI training models, whatever.
So that's the 256 part. Okay. Now let's talk about the second part of the string, the other 86 characters. The notes call this the hash.
This is the identity, the fingerprint. A hash function is just a mathematical algorithm. You feed a file into it. Doesn't matter if it's a one-word text file or a 4K movie, and the algorithm spits out a unique string of characters.
And the key thing about a hash is that it's one way, right? You can't look at the fingerprint and recreate the person.
Exactly.
But if you have the person, you can always check if the fingerprint matches.
That's it. And it's incredibly sensitive. They called it the avalanche effect.
Mm-hmm.
If you take a digital copy of War and Peace and you change a single period to a comma and then run the hash again,
the new string would be totally different.
Completely unrecognizable from the first one. Yeah.
Okay, so the 256.6 spec uses a specific algorithm called SHA-512. Why that one?
SHA-512 is an industry standard for high security. It produces a fingerprint that is 512 bits long.
Okay, let's do the math again. I want to see how we get to the URL length. So 512 bits.
Right. And there are 8 bits in a byte. So you just divide 512 by 8.
That's 64 bytes.
So the fingerprint of the file is 64 bytes of raw data.
But you can't put raw data in a URL bar.
Exactly. It would just look like garbage and break everything. So just like with the file size, we have to translate those 64 bytes into base64 text.
And that conversion, that's what gets us to the 86 characters.
That's it. When you convert 64 bytes into base64, it takes up about 86 characters of text.
So there's our formula. 8 characters for the size plus 86 characters for the unique fingerprint. That's our 94 characters.
And if that string is your guarantee. When you see that URL, you know two things instantly. Nope. Exactly how big the file is and exactly what its mathematical contents are.
It's like a tamper-proof seal built right into the link.
That's a perfect way to put it.
Now, this brings us to a really interesting practical thing, caching. The source material says content in the system is immutable and can be cached indefinitely. Can you unpack why that's such a big deal for the internet?
Oh, it's huge. Right now, your browser and your ISP, they're constantly acting like detectives.
Yeah.
When you go to a website you visited before, they have to ask, hey, do I still have the right image? Did the website owner update it?
Right, and that takes time and bandwidth.
A lot of it. But with 256, because the address is the content, you never have to check. If I have a file on my computer that matches that 94-character ID, I know with mathematical certainty that it is the correct file.
It can't be an old version.
It can't be. Because a different version would have a different ID.
So if I update my website, I just generate new IDs, and the old IDs, they still point to the old stuff.
Correct. This means once a file is downloaded, it never, ever needs to be downloaded again by that user. It can just sit in a cache forever.
That sounds almost perfect. But I have to be the skeptic for a second. The documentation mentions collisions, and collisions are usually bad.
They are. A collision in this context means two totally different files accidentally produce the exact same fingerprint.
So I ask for a picture of a cat, but the math gets confused and it sends me a picture of a dog because they just happen to have the same hash.
Theoretically, yes. But let's look at the probability. We are using SHA-512. The number of possible combinations is 2 to the power of 512.
Which is a big number.
It's a number so large that there aren't enough atoms in the known universe to write it down.
Okay, so the odds are low.
Low is an understatement. It's statistically impossible in the lifetime of the universe. The creator, Kurt Cox, he actually addresses this in the spec. He writes, I'm comfortable just ignoring accidental problem collisions.
He's basically just saying the math is on my side.
He is. But he does make a distinction for adversarial collisions.
Adversarial? That sounds like hackers.
Right. Suppose someone wants to break this system. They try to manufacture a fake file, maybe a virus, that generates the exact same fingerprint as a safe file you trust.
Can they do that?
Not with any technology we have today. It would take an insane amount of computing power. But in security, you never say never. So the protocol has a really simple rule. Verify CID content.
Which means don't just trust the label on the box.
Exactly. When you download the file, your computer should run the SHA-512 math on it locally. If the fingerprint it calculates matches the one in the URL, you're safe. If it doesn't, you know something is wrong and you just delete it. It's a trust but verify model.
I like that. It puts the power in the hands of the user. You don't have to trust the server, you just have to trust the math.
Precisely.
Okay, now I want to pivot to what was honestly my favorite part of the reading. We've been talking about these huge files and these long fingerprints, but what happens if the file is tiny?
Ah, yes. The small file loophole.
I saw this in the anatomy section. The spec says if the content is less than or equal to 64 bytes, you don't hash it.
Right. Think about it. The fingerprint itself is 64 bytes long. So if your entire message is just the word hello, which is what, 5 bytes?
That's a ridiculous situation.
It is. You'd have a 5-byte payload and a 64-byte label. The receipt is bigger than the item you bought.
So what does 256 do instead?
It just flips the script. If the data is small enough, it doesn't create a fingerprint at all. It takes the data itself, encodes it into that Base64 text, and it puts the actual data into the URL path.
Wait, hold on. So the file isn't stored on the server?
The file is the URL.
I love the analogy we talked about. It's like sending a letter. Usually you put the letter in an envelope and you write an address on the outside. But for these small files, 256T basically says, forget the envelope, just write the message on a postcard.
That's the perfect way to visualize it. The address is the message.
And think about what that means for a server. If I send a request with one of these small file URLs...
The server doesn't have to look anything up. Yeah. It doesn't check a database. It doesn't spin up a hard drive.
It just listens at the request.
Decodes the text and reflects it right back to you. It's like a mirror. The data didn't exist on the server until you asked for it. You brought the data with you.
That's mind-bending. It means you could have a serverless interaction where data is just bouncing around in the links, never actually resting on a disk anywhere.
For small pieces of data, yeah. Things like configuration keys, short messages, verification tokens. It removes the need for storage entirely. The network itself becomes the storage.
And it solves the immutability problem for small files, too.
Flawlessly. Because if the URL is the content, you obviously can't change the content without changing the URL. You change hello to hola, the URL is different.
This feels like one of those elegant engineering solutions that just solves three problems at once. But I want to ground this for a second. We're talking about a specification. Is 256T a company? Is there a CEO? Can I sign up for a plan?
No, no, and no. And that's a crucial distinction. There's a section in the README called Beyond the Scope of This Text.
Okay.
And it's very clear. 256 is a protocol. It's a set of rules.
Like MP3 is for music.
Exactly like MP3. The MP3 format tells you how to arrange bits to make music. It doesn't tell you where to buy the song or who owns the copyright or what speakers to use. 256 is the MP3 of storage URLs.
So it doesn't tell you where the file actually lives?
The document asks, how do I find some place that publishes CIDs? And the answer is basically, that's not my problem.
Huh, really?
Pretty much. It also doesn't handle permissions. It doesn't care if a file is private or public. It just cares that the name matches the content.
That purity is kind of refreshing. It's not trying to sell you a cloud subscription. It's just trying to fix how we name things.
And because it's just a set of rules, just math,
yeah.
It's incredibly portable. I was looking at the implementations listed in the repository. It's impressive.
It's not just one language, right?
No, it's everywhere. You've got your standard heavy hitters like Java, Python, C++A, Go. But then you have implementations in Rust, Clojure, Elm.
I even saw Bash and PowerShell on the list.
Which is wild. That means you can implement this system using standard command line tools that are already installed on, you know, basically every computer in the world.
You don't need a fancy engine.
You just need to be able to calculate a hash and do Base64 encoding.
The repository also links to some tools so you can actually see this in action, right? There's a hash calculator and a file CID check.
Yeah, which sticks to the philosophy of show, don't just tell. You can go to the site, drag a photo of your dog into the browser, and it will spit out that 256-tip string.
And that string is now the universal mathematical name for that specific photo.
Exactly. If anyone else in the world has that exact same photo, they will generate the exact same string. It creates a universal namespace for data.
So let's zoom out as we wrap up. Why should the average listener, someone who isn't coding back-end servers, why should they care about this? What's the big takeaway?
I think it represents a shift towards a cleaner web. We've just gotten so used to the idea that links rot, the files disappear, or that you download something and you're wondering, is this the right version?
Final V2 realedit.doc.
Exactly that. 256T offers a glimpse of a web where links are permanent and verifiable. It shifts the trust from the institution to the information itself.
So you don't have to trust that the server admin kept the file safe.
The link itself proves the file hasn't been changed. It's all about integrity.
Right.
Whether it's for archiving scientific data so we know it hasn't been tampered with, or just preserving digital history, this protocol offers a standard mathematical way to do it.
I keep going back to that provocative thought about the small files. If we adopted this standard, could we build an entire messaging system or even a serverless internet where the data just exists in the request itself?
It's a fascinating thought experiment. I mean, imagine an internet that doesn't remember anything. It just processes what you handed in the moment.
No databases to hack, no hard drives to crash.
The data lives in the transit. Sounds like sci-fi, but the 256 spec makes it technically possible today.
It really challenges our assumption that data always has to sit on a hard drive somewhere.
It blurs the line between the map and the territory. For 256, the map is the territory.
Wow, I don't know about you, but I'm definitely going to be looking at my URL bar a little differently from now on.
It's hard not to, right?
That wraps up our deep dive into 256t.org. We hope this gave you a new perspective on the invisible architecture that holds our digital world together. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.